that seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes, everyone but you. And when I do, I'll see you standing there. Say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day. And through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And hello and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guest is Diane Leffer. Diane is an author, playwright, and activist whose most recent book, California Transit, which she's here to talk about today, was awarded the Mary McCarthy Prize in Short Fiction. Her stories, novels, and nonfiction often address social issues and draw on such experiences as going to jail for civil disobedience, and her volunteer work as a legal assistant interpreter for immigrants in detention. She has collaborated with exiled Colombian theater artist Hector Aristiz on, I don't know if I have his whole name. When you're on, you can help me with that. On Nightwind, about his arrest and torture by the U.S.-supported military in Colombia, a play that has toured theaters, campuses, conferences, and houses of worship throughout the U.S. and Canada. Diana's picked potatoes, typed autopsy reports, surveyed parolees and drug addicts about their sex lives, and taught creative writing to gangbangers, as well as, for 20 years, to graduate students in the MFA and writing program at Vermont College in Vermont. She received the 2006-2007 City of Los Angeles Literary Arts Fellowship in support of Phantom Heart, her novel in progress, set in and around Southern California, around a nuclear waste site. She lives in L.A., and again, she's here to talk about California Transit, published by Sarah Bonde Press. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Great to have you. And you're in the studio. I so rarely have people in the studio, authors in the studio with me, so it's quite interesting. How do you pronounce his name?
Hector Aristizabal.
Okay. Yeah, part of the word was missing here.
As soon as you put an accent in a word, my hard drive is crashing. As soon as you put an accent in your computer's, your word processing
right.
program,
right, right.
it tends to not transmit.
It yeah, it, or turns it into something.
Something weird.
Let's first talk about California Transit, a collection of short stories. Tell me how the book came about.
Well, it's what's weird about it is people keep saying, oh, you really know California, you really know Los Angeles. And I think I sort of wrote this book. I moved out here about 11 years ago and started writing the book to figure out where I was living. I started traveling around, taking buses, trying to get to know this amazing place that I had decided to make my home, and felt completely overwhelmed at first. L.A. was just too big and complicated to write about, so I was living in Long Beach, and I sort of decided that Pedro was more manageable, San Pedro.
Mm-hmm.
And I started focusing on Pedro for a while. And bit by bit, I live in L.A. now, and I kind of feel that I really am an Angeleno at this point.
And you came from New York?
Yes.
And something I read about you, you said something to the effect of, that you love L.A. and that New York, it just became difficult to pay the rent. I mean, just all your energy was going into that.
Yes, I think to me, I was born in New York City, and I really always considered it the center of the world. And then it suddenly became just, it seemed like the center of world capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just that I couldn't afford to live there. Most of my friends had been forced out. Our neighbors, I lived on West 82nd Street on the greatest block in the world. It was like a village. We all knew each other. We used to, everyone would chip in money and we would charter a boat and go off Sheepshead Bay and catch fish, and the people mm-hmm. who didn't want to go on the boat. And we took all the kids, even, you know, from the families that had no money. There was always, we could always take the kids with us. Everyone else would stay behind and bake cakes. We had a moonshiner who would go to his still and get the corn liquor. And people would make salads. We'd come back and have these incredible fish fries that the whole neighborhood would participate in. And people chipped in nickels and dimes to plant trees on the street and build brick tree guards around them. As soon as those trees grew up and gave shade, we were a desirable block, and it became gentrified. Mm-hmm. And the people sure. who planted the trees were forced out.
Mm-hmm.
So it just became harder and harder to live there. And I think the worst thing was we had washing machines in the basement, and I went down one day to do the laundry, and all of the electric cords had been cut because the guy who lived closest to the laundry room didn't want to hear the machines running. So he took shears and he cut all the cords.
Nice.
I mean, people just did not...
Yeah.
Well, you get it.
Yeah.
So I moved to L.A.
So you moved to L.A. and... What you said made me think of something I was talking about last night with my students, which is that, you know, all writers have different ways of working, but some writers, myself included, write to, or in our writing, we are trying to find out things that we don't know already. We don't have our story plotted out and outlined to know exactly what's going to happen, but we're writing to discover. It sounds like that's what you're saying.
Right, very much.
So Talk a little bit about your title story, California Transit, which I liked that it was such a long story and that a lot of your stories in this collection are long,
mm-hmm.
because I think especially just the contrarian in me. So often when you're trying to publish short stories, they say under 3,000 words, the shorter the better. And you have some very long stories in here. In California Transit's almost a novella, I would think.
Yeah, it is a novella. I think I'm sort of someone who wanted to be a novelist and wants to write novels, but my mind tends to compress everything. So I bite off more than I can chew, and it ends up being a long story.
Mm-hmm. The point of view of California Transit, it's so interesting because I hadn't talked to you at all yet, and I'm always trying to find the author in between the lines. And I know that you do some work with the LA Zoo, the Los Angeles
yes.
Zoo. And there's a lot about sort of animals from the point of view of somebody who is empathetic knows animals, knows sort of the downtrodden or the underdog. Where did the story begin? How did the story begin?
The story actually began, I was in a place, I was in a crummy room, and I won't say where, because it will embarrass the people whose room it was.
Okay.
I was in a crummy room, and I looked around, and I just thought, here I am again in a crummy room. And I wrote like this little poem about crummy rooms I had been in my life. And a lot of times I was really happy being in those crummy rooms. It's not like necessarily a negative when I call something crummy. And so I wrote this little poem, and then I got home, and the poem just kept growing and growing and growing until it was, you know, about 180 pages long. So that's where it came from.
Hmm.
And just a lot of stuff I had been thinking about. I think a lot of issues of nonviolence come out in the work, even when the writing sometimes seems violent, because to me, nonviolence isn't a decision that you make once in your life and then it's over and done with, mm-hmm. and you can live by that principle. For me, it's something I struggle with all the time. I mean, you just sort of have to decide every day, I want to take that approach rather than going for revenge or rather than hurting myself. And I don't think my characters have quite figured that out yet,
mm-hmm.
but that's a preoccupation, I think, in a lot of the writing.
That's interesting. Because your main character is, your main character has not figured that out. And actually, what she ends up doing toward the end of this book seems to be, is shocking to her.
Yeah.
She had no sort of preconception of where she was going in this particular relationship with Burton.
Right, right.
You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'm here with Diane Leffer. Today we're talking about California Transit, a collection of short stories published by Sarabande Books. So Sarabande is a
Saraband. Yeah.
Saraband?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, see, I'm putting accents where there are none.
It sounds beautiful.
I'm taking them out of other words. I'm just messing it all up. So it's a nonprofit press. From right. what I understand.
And very independent and nonprofit.
Talk about that. How did you hook up with them?
Well, okay, people like me who ain't got no agent, what you do is you send your books to competitions.
Uh-huh.
And so this was a competition that Sarabande sponsors, and Carol Masso, who I will bow yeah. down in front of if I ever meet
sure.
her, chose
she was
it
a judge.
As the winner. She was the judge.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, there are still some places where you can take your work if you're not already, you know, plugged mm-hmm. into the whole system.
Mm-hmm. And Sarabande is one.
Yeah. And besides the prize-winning books, they have a list of just fine poetry and nonfiction and fiction that they publish. But this was my foot in the door.
Interesting. Will you read from the title story,
sure.
California Transit? That'd be great.
Okay. The sea lions stopped barking after the last feeding. It was quiet there at night, except for the occasional sneeze and the constant sound of water moved by wind. I stood at the fence in the dark, and sometimes a patrol car came by, and I'd turn and wave as if I were one of the volunteers who belonged there. The female I came to watch slept peacefully, but sometimes there was a tremor through her light-colored fur, and her flippers trembled against the pavement. This is where I got to know Burton. Even when you're most alone, there's bound to be someone. This is what happened in Los Angeles, the land of reinvention. I didn't come west to reinvent myself. What I didn't expect, after I arrived, I had to reinvent my desire to go on living. I found myself in a bare room with a shared bathroom down the hall. Utilities were included, so I got no mail. It sounds a defeat to say I found myself there. I chose it. I turned down an apartment with a balcony overlooking the Pacific and the sandy beach beneath the bluff. From the living room window, the view was of the working harbor, the gantry cranes and offshore rigs, and in the distance the 40-foot containers piled on rail beds all along the flats. Even the kitchen had a view, the other side of the point where the shore was rocky and wild. I could have had a place with carpets and ceiling fans, the second floor of a pretty little stucco house with ring-necked doves cooing on the flat roof, with rose bushes, with bougainvillea spilling over the stucco wall. Then I saw what I needed, the room to let over a line of boarded-up stores and scaffolding somewhere in between the homeless feeding station and the spruced-up block that people called Yuppie Gulch. The room reminded me of the past. In 1968... after the assassinations, when I was 22 years old, I'd run off and lived in San Andres, an industrial port on Mexico's east coast. It was a new city, modern and open, and so different from the other Mexican towns I'd seen with their adobe walls that gave the street a human scale and hugged you. San Andres was not a city that could love. I rented an ugly room in someone's apartment. I knew no one. I never got enough to eat. I was very much alone. And very happy. When I arrived in L.A., I was 2 years past 50. I'd left New York at the end of my rope, and en route to California, I lost everything. Empty hands are unencumbered hands. That's what I believed when I lived in the port of San Andres, and I thought, I can be that woman again. I thought, don't despair. Revel in your freedom. It was only natural to take the bus down to San Pedro, the city L.A. annexed, in order to have a harbor. I moved into my little room. Emptiness is conducive to the meditative state. There was no reason I couldn't be happy.
Thank you so much. That was Diane Leffer reading from California Transit, the title story called California Transit. Did this story, it has such a, the voice is so consistent throughout, and such a sort of, what am I trying, well, when I was reading it, what was I thinking? That it was sort of a quiet, solitary person at the end of her rope, that sort of desperation, but understated desperation, perhaps that's it. And I'm curious how you hooked into the voice, or do you just, is that your voice? Is that your voice?
It tends to just come. I mean, I think I'm always so afraid of being too sentimental. I'm always afraid of being too emotional. So I do pull it back. But I also felt this was part, I was looking for a kind of post-traumatic voice, mm-hmm. this numbness, because again, talking about the violence that's been repressed here and the rage and all the pain that she has not been able to deal with. She needed to connect with people. She needed to be active. You know, there were things that could have averted the trouble that's coming. And instead, I'm sympathetic towards her, but I'm angry with her. And there is that numbness throughout.
Numbness, that's the word. Yeah, she's definitely numb. But she has, for maybe half the story, she has a little cat.
Yes.
A little cat named Dinah. Mm-hmm. And I just love this cat character. Is your involvement, well, I would think your involvement with animals just naturally places animals throughout all of your work, which it seems
to. I love animals. I do love animals. And I'm always, I mean, I may not succeed in this either, but I'm always uncomfortable when I feel animals are being used as symbols or being used as props. To me, they are, their intelligence, their emotions. And when you live with animals, they amaze you all the time. And I want animals to be full characters in their own right. I don't want to use them as, you know, stage dressing or anything. To my cat, one of the things, it's like if I bang into the furniture and I go, ouch, my cat, I think where you're hurt, it must get hotter or something, because she'll always go right to where it hurts and, you know, put her face there. And I know the morning of 9/11, when I heard what had happened, I let out, you know, this cry of pain. And my cat came, and she climbed all over me trying to find the place that hurt.
Interesting.
And she couldn't find it. And I just sort of was thankful that there was a living creature in the room with me who didn't know what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's not about their intelligence.
Right.
But it's about, she was showing that concern, but she didn't have to know. She didn't have the burden of what I knew.
Right.
And that made me love her all the more. I don't know.
It's interesting, though. That's one thing I so liked about this book, this collection of stories, was all the you know, involvement of the animals. They didn't seem like stage dressing or props. So,
thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for letting them in into your work. You have another story where your character is transporting a head.
An antelope's head.
Antelope's head. Talk about that story and how that came about.
I need to quote someone, because Ruthie Yakushiji at the zoo actually had to transport an antelope's
head. A Las Falada.
Yes.
Okay.
The story of Las Falada. So Ruthie actually did transport an antelope's head. And after the book came out, all these people went to her because they knew she had done that and said, is the story true? And she said, it's true, except for the dialogues, the emotions, and what happens. And I thought, that is the best description I have ever heard of being a writer. So I've stolen that from her.
Right.
I love it.
That's great. It's true, except for the
dialogue, the emotions, and what happens.
Yeah. So do you do that a lot? I mean, do you take, it sounds like you'll take the essence of something. You see the story and the essence, and then write the story, like this one we're talking about, A Las Falada.
I've been thinking about this all week for other reasons, that I was thinking about how stupid I used to be, that I had this idea that imagination meant a mental construct, that you had to make it up sort of out of thin air. And I was terrible at description. I couldn't describe a building or a house or a room or what people wore, because I'm not an architect, and I just couldn't make it up. And it wasn't until I read a biography of Charlotte Bronte, and it talked about the buildings that had served as the models for the places in her fiction. I thought, you can, like, it's not cheating. You know, you can do that.
Right.
And the same sort of thing, I think, has come up. I won't go into the whole long thing, but sometimes when we take our authority from other books we've read instead of really trusting our own experience and our own senses, I did that when I started writing. I did that all the time without even realizing it. Because I think for me, what imagination has come to be is a sort of improvisational use of everything, including my intellect and what I read. But the stuff I experience, places I go, words I hear, everything from my senses, but you improvise with it.
Yeah.
And I feel much freer doing that. And I also feel much freer using some of the non-literary work I do. Because again, people have say things that just really affect you. I met a Canadian author many, many years ago who did a lot of work with the homeless and in battered women's shelter. And she had made a very strict division in her life where she just sort of swore to herself that she would never write about any of her social-oriented work, that she never wanted anyone to feel she was exploiting them. She never wanted to feel she was doing that work to get material.
Sure.
And I was so impressed by the ethics of that, that I sort of made that oath. You know, I sort of thought that would be a really nice thing to be that ethical. But eventually I felt these subjects are way too serious. Mm-hmm. And if this is part of my life and I'm seeing these things, how can I leave it out? In right. fact, it's my responsibility to write about it. But I know for a long time I censored some of that material because it somehow seemed dirty to use it.
So do you ever run pieces by people that might recognize parts of themselves, or do you ever feel a need to have your work, you know, vetted or looked at, or do you just figure that you're creating fiction out of something and it's not going to be recognizable? The people are not necessarily going to be recognizable. And what do you do with all that?
I think I may have done that once or twice, but honestly, years ago when I was broke, I'm still broke, but years ago when I was broke and I was borrowing money for the rent, I wrote a couple of Regency romances under a pseudonym. And those are those,
Harlequins.
Yeah, they're like Harlequins, but they're historical. They're right. set in the 1800s and they're British royalty. Mm-hmm. And the first one that came out, one of my aunts was furious with me and she said I'd revealed all the family's secrets. And we were like, you know, peasant immigrants, Jewish immigrants from what is now Poland, you know? Yeah. I could not even imagine what secrets I had revealed in this book about royalty, and she wouldn't tell me. But she was very angry. And that was when I stopped worrying about it. You can't control this stuff. Although when I write nonfiction, even if I don't use people's names, I do tend to discuss it with them or show them what I've written. Mm-hmm. I'm working on a book now, in fact, with Hector Istisabal, a nonfiction book. And we talk about a lot of lives and I quote a lot of people and I have gone to them, shown just about everyone. I haven't finished going to everyone, but everyone will see it and approve it or say, please take it
now,
out.
Now, what's the difference for you? Where with fiction, you've stopped worrying about it, but nonfiction, because nonfiction is assumed to be true.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And also, actually, we don't have, I mean, some of the people can't be reached, and some of the people, mm-hmm. it's a first name and it's a pseudonym, but in nonfiction, sometimes you want to give a full name. You want that.
Right.
Authority, and I wouldn't do that without. Well, I'm not trying to trap anyone or trick anyone right. in this book. We want it to be a helpful book.
Yeah. Sure. Interesting. Okay, we're going to take a real short break. So, all of you out there, stay with us. Diane will be back for the second half, and we'll read again from California Transit. So, stay tuned. Don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
We're back. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm here with Diane Leffer today, and her book is California Transit. We're going to pick it up again. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
There's another story in this book I wanted to talk about. It's a story about a California woman who is deported. I think it's called, here it is, At the Site Where Vision is Most Perfect. Talk about this story and how this story came about.
That's my propaganda story, but I still like it. In 1999, I ended up going into the detention centers where immigrants are held pending deportation, including people who are applying for asylum, people who are appealing their deportation. Thousands of people are held in L.A. County, some on Terminal Island in the harbor, some up in Lancaster. At the time, kids were being housed in a facility along with gangbangers. I met these little boys who were being pepper sprayed when they didn't follow orders in English, which they didn't understand. You know, I mean, it's still a very, the kids aren't, they're not allowed to do that to kids anymore, but it's still a very, very bad situation. And I was, Amnesty International couldn't get access to the prisoners. Journalists weren't allowed in. I got in because I was working for some agencies. I volunteered for some lawyers who apparently were going to take some of these cases, were going to do something about the abuses. I was taking out affidavits from people about the abuse they were experiencing in detention. And nothing was done. Nothing was done at all. And so I'm going to save the world. I think I'll write a long, short story. That's really going to, everyone's going to read this, right? So anyway, when it came time to writing it, I had tried to get media attention to the problem. And one of the things, I talked to people at some of the major magazines in New York that I had written for in the past, and there was an attitude, well, no one really cares about immigrants. And I was saying, one in eight Americans is an immigrant. Everybody is married to an immigrant or is friends with an immigrant or is an immigrant. But that was the kind of attitude. And there was also the feeling, all of the people that I interviewed in the detention centers were poor. That's why they were looking for free legal assistance. And I had, before that started, met a professional woman from Peru who was held for months and months and months on a computer error. She ended up taking voluntary deportation, flying back to Peru, and then turning around and coming back because her papers were entirely in order. She lost months of her life, thousands of dollars, and several months out of her career. But these days you can't even do that anymore. If you take voluntary deportation, there's no coming back. But I thought, okay, I do know that there are very well-educated, English-speaking professionals who get into the situation, even if those weren't the people that I was interviewing. Right. And I call this my propaganda piece because I made up my mind that I was going to write about a family, an all-American family, the kind of family that could be anyone. Because I really wanted to tell that story, even though there were so many just awful stories that I encountered myself.
Yeah, I think most of us don't think about this sort of thing, even living here in Southern California, where people are regularly detained for long periods of time. And your character in this story, who is a professional in L.A., who they just never got married. Her and her husband, they didn't get married. They had a child. They're living in L.A.
Well, they are married at this point.
Oh, at this point. Yeah. Okay, but they weren't married at first.
Yeah.
And it's so hard. It's hard to imagine how this sort of thing happen.
This sort of thing. In 1996, there was a new immigration reform that included that anybody who'd ever been convicted, even with a green card, who was here legally, anyone convicted of an aggravated felony should be deported. And that sounds reasonable till you realize that aggravated felonies included things that we consider minor things, smoking marijuana one day, and that it included things people had been arrested for maybe 20 years ago. And so it was made retroactive. And what I saw a lot of were people who were arrested who didn't have any money, as the woman at the time she was arrested in my story, and she's, just out of school, they offered a plea bargain. And they said, you know, take the plea, plead guilty, and you go home. No jail time, no fine, nothing. A lot of people took those deals, and it came back to bite them 20 years later when this law was made retroactive, and they were suddenly subject to deportation.
So your character, even though she didn't quite do anything wrong, she goes through this, and so this drug conviction is on her record.
She was in the house where drugs were being used because she was there as the architect, and so she got picked up. And
that's enough.
Yeah, that was enough to have her deported. But first, I mean, a lot of the things in the story are true. The facilities are so overcrowded. There aren't enough beds. So when they take people into custody, they tend to put them in holding cells and drive them around on buses all night. And until you're actually in the system, no one can reach you. No one even knows where you are. And people would be driven around all night and then told to sleep on the floor somewhere and then put back on the bus. And when they finally get into these detention centers, it's not even as good as our prisons. Everything is taken from you. So, you know, no underwear, no toothbrush, because there aren't enough to go around. It's all this just absolutely crazy stuff.
Well, you have some, I mean, there's, I don't want to say funny stuff in this story, but, you know, certain lines where she just wants her own prison.
Yeah.
She wants a prison to call home because of this, you know, not being able to be settled.
That being in limbo for so long.
And, you know, a bed to call her own. You just had to, you know, this sort of little laugh comes out. And you're not laughing at it. You're just going, how is this possible?
But I think that's the other thing we tend to censor out when we're being serious. I mean, life can be grim, but the humor is always there. Funny things are happening all the time, or people's funny perspective. And it's so easy to censor that out. I don't try to be funny, you know, but I just try not to censor it.
Right. Because there's a lot of humor through the book, and it's not hee-haw slapstick funny, but it's just funny. What about the first story, Naked Chinese People? Talk about this one and how this story came about.
That story came about partly because at Vermont College I was collaborating with a poet, Natasha Saye. We wanted to do a seminar about writing about the other. We had so many students, white students, who were writing from the point of view of African Americans or Latinos or whatever, and sometimes they didn't really have a good sense of what they were doing. And we did not want apartheid in literature. People should be able to write about anyone or anything, but there are ways that make sense and there are ways that don't. So anyway, we were working on a seminar on this subject, and it made me start thinking about race and racial attitudes. And part of the essay and the lecture I wrote then just started disappearing and turning into fiction. And then along the way, I kind of got stuck, and I was sitting in a classical music concert one day, and bam, I suddenly knew what was happening in the story. All of a sudden, it had a plot. Which plot is like the thing I'm worst at.
Mm-hmm.
So those are sort of the roots of that story. But the thing is, again, some of the stuff is so weird. I was working on a theater festival with an actor director named Anthony Lee, and a week after we met, he was shot and killed by the police. He was a big, tall, gorgeous black man, and the very first time I met him, he was someone who sort of is so charming, goes out of his way to put you at ease, that my first impression was, here's someone who's been hassled by the cops.
Mm-hmm.
And a week later, he was dead. Mm-hmm. An accident, tragic, you know, mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And then the story was published, and almost everyone I know who read it assumed it was about Anthony Lee, and it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it's not that unusual an occurrence, I guess.
Right.
But I think of him now whenever the story is mentioned. Of course, that's who I think of.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Diane Leffer, author of the collection California Transit. Will you read to us again?
Sure.
And
I think I was going to do a short piece from At the Site Where Vision is Most Perfect.
That'd be great.
His mother put in her papers and waited more than 5 years. At last they called her for the citizenship interview. She took the day off from work. She went downtown. She entered the office. Next thing she knew, there were handcuffs on her wrist. Her legs were shackled. She was not to be a citizen, but a prisoner. Matt walks Ruby, slamming the door as he leaves the house, behind him. Ruby twists and whines and whimpers, not like herself at all. Does she smell a skunk or a coyote, or just that something is very wrong? Border collie. For a moment, hers is a very suspect breed, though with reference to collies, this refers to the border counties between England and Scotland. Okay, not American, but clearly Anglo and white. His mom missed Christmas, and now she'll miss the New Year, too. He doesn't get it. His mother speaks English. She's had a green card forever. His grandparents had a McDonald's franchise outside of Bangor, Maine. You can't get more American than that. And yet he almost envies her adventure. To be falsely accused, forced to endure, to prove yourself, ultimately to triumph, to learn ultimate things you'll never learn in school. What his mother has already learned. 1. Women are better off with male guards. When you have your period, the men get embarrassed and give you a napkin right away, even extras, so you won't have to ask again. The women pretend not to hear you. They ignore you, then humiliate you and call you dirty when you bleed. 2. They don't launder the jumpsuits very well. She's itching and scratching. 3. What she has, Myrta tells her, is sarna. 4. It's a new Spanish word for her. Sarna means scabies.
Thank you so much. Ah, that was Diane Leffer reading from her collection, California Transit, published by Sarabande Press. And this collection was the winner of the 2005 Mary McCarthy Prize in Short Fiction, selected by Carol Mazo. A few minutes ago, you mentioned plot and the difficulty with plot. So let's talk about plot, because a lot of writers will enjoy the fact that you find it difficult and you teach in an MFA program and, you know, you have all these publications. And so that, because writers, I think, get very hung up around plot. Mm-hmm. We get, you know, so hung up and feel that if we don't do it well, how can we go on living? How can we call ourselves writers? Talk about that.
I don't, to me, plot is the least interesting part of a story. I'm so much more interested in the characters and the way they move through the world. But something has to happen. I mean, and I think my stories are more constructed almost like mosaics, where I think the satisfaction comes from having the pieces fall together rather than from having some kind of illumination in the end, like, or a mystery being solved. Because I think life is full of mystery, but I don't think it's like a mystery novel where there's ever any solutions. Mm-hmm. So I do try to put the mystery of life into the stories.
But you don't, when you start a story, you find your way into a story, you're not worrying about plot. Exactly.
Oh, I think I'm not worrying about anything. I think of writing more and more as improvisation. Hmm. And when you're improvising, you don't know what you're going to end up with. But I think I need that freedom. If I have to, every now and then someone asks you for an outline, I hate that. That's the worst thing in the world. If I know where I'm going, why go?
Why go?
And I look, my friend Francois Comin, wonderful writer, this isn't quite on plot, but he says, you know, you can go into one of these botanical gardens where everything is labeled, where you learn what the names of the flowers are and what the names of the trees are, or you can just walk through nature and go, oh, with wonder at what you're seeing. And I am so much more interested in the sense of wonder than in the labels.
Sure. That makes sense. Yeah, because, I mean, I know for some people plot and outline are everything.
Yeah.
And important, and they do it and write wonderful books. And for others, like me, plot, I think I did a plot once, an outline once for a book, and ended up not writing the book because I was so bored at the end of that I didn't want to spend time. Kind of what you're saying.
Yeah, and I sometimes have a sense of where it's going. Sometimes I know the end, but I have no idea what has to happen. I have no idea what's going on or who these people are, and you write your way into it. The thing, I think you just have to not be afraid of not knowing. I think when I started writing, I was probably very afraid, and also I was working full time and at a very boring job. So I would tend to have the story already all written in my head by the time I had enough time to put it, to type it out. Mm-hmm. And I published some of those stories, but they weren't as interesting and they weren't as much fun to write. And it's not what I want to do.
Yeah. Well, teaching. I wanted to talk a little bit about teaching because you teach at Vermont College in the MFA program. Mm. I don't think you don't have an MFA.
I dropped out of college.
So, how is it?
It was a fluke. It was a lucky fluke. Got me out of the gutter.
So how do you teach writing? How do you teach in an MFA program? In terms of, I mean, not how do you do it, but your experience is so different, and it seems that your writing has come out of your life in a very organic way, as opposed to going through an MFA program. But now you teach in one.
Right.
So how does all that go together?
Well, I was terrified when I got called to go up there. It was a sort of emergency. Mm-hmm. The college needed someone at the last minute, and at that time I was in New York, and it was like an hour airplane ride away, and I showed up, and I figured, well, I'll be fired any minute, you know. And 20 years later, I'm still there. Yeah. So I don't know how that happened. But I felt much more confident at Vermont than I would have at a traditional mm-hmm. school, because it's a low residency program where we work individually with each student. I mean, yes, there are some lectures and workshops.
Right.
But basically, you're looking at someone's work, and you're enthusiastic about it, and you're asking questions about it, and you're giving them suggestions based on whatever, you know, whatever I've learned over the years mm-hmm. through trial and error. I mean, I think the students in this program are going to learn in a couple of years what took me my lifetime to learn.
Yeah.
Because they have someone to talk to about it. I think I would find it hard to walk into a classroom. I don't know that I would be good at that. Mm-hmm. And even in the workshops, I just couldn't stand the way workshops were done, where the writer had to be silent. I don't
right.
get that point at all. And so I said, no gag rule. Everybody talks. And we ask questions of the writer, and the writer asks questions of the other participants. And I also started to feel, especially because our program, students get such intensive one-on-one attention from their own particular advisor. I'm not saying I pull punches in workshop, but it didn't seem necessary to criticize people publicly in a very cruel way when they were going to get that in private.
Right.
So, you know, what for?
Right.
And why should students sit there in the workshop busy thinking, oh, who's the star in this workshop mm-hmm. and who is not any good? Yeah, I can't tell from workshop material who's going to publish next year. I mean, I can't tell at all. So I find it much more interesting. And people say, well, when you submit the work to the publisher, you don't get to talk back. But in workshop, it's a work in progress. Mm-hmm. And I'd much rather ask people questions. So many times people start answering questions and they say all the words that should have been in the story that they somehow didn't think were interesting enough.
Right.
I love doing that. And I also love in the individual correspondence with students, I teach a lot from having people read and really look at the books they're reading, not as readers, but as writers, looking at the techniques, looking at the strategies that different writers use, and really analyzing aspects of bad writing and of good writing. I find that helps people just make all kinds of progress. Mm. When you're only looking at your own work or at the other students' work, it's not as effective. Mm. And what people learn when they get a master's in literature is a very different approach than you get as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's so structured. It's sort of like you pick out the symbols in the story, which means someone had to dig a hole and bury the symbols in the story. And when you're right, you don't do that.
Right.
You don't do that. So it's a way of helping people discover what they really care about and getting them to trust their intuition, and then teaching them some of the nuts and bolts. Especially tightening and restructuring. When I first sent stories out, editors were always saying it needs tightening. And I didn't even know, I had no idea what they were talking
right.
about. What does that mean?
Right.
So
editing your own work. How
yeah.
do you do that? Yeah.
So you edit with someone as a team. You work on editing their work until they pick up how to do it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like to impose. You know, it's their work. So it's all suggestions.
It's interesting. I went to Goddard College, which turned into Vermont College.
Right.
And when I was, a few years ago, we went back east because I was thinking of graduate school. And I actually had started collecting letters of recommendation because I was going to apply to Vermont College. And then when I came back from Vermont after sort of touring around, came back and my agent sold my book. So I figured I have to stay here and finish my book now. Okay. But Vermont College was the one.
So we could have met years earlier.
So funny. But the low residency idea, I think, just works so well for you know, working writers, people with families, just, you know, where you can't really leave your life for 2 years and go to graduate school, but you can work on a graduate degree while you're living your life.
And I think writers should have a life outside of their writing. Yeah. And also, I mean, I'm sure that people get a lot out of going to school every day, but if you're a writer, you need to be working independently. Going into a classroom, how is that every day? How is that going to make you a writer? I'm sorry. I'm prejudiced. But I don't see that as being as effective as a low residency program where students are able to get individual attention but have to continue with their lives and work on their own for stretches of time.
Mm-hmm. How does it influence your own writing teaching?
I learned a lot when I had to, when you have to start explaining things to students, it's been really great. And I've worked with some really talented people. And it keeps you on your toes. I've gotten a lot out of it.
Interesting.
It became my own MFA, I think, because I had to learn in order to teach.
Mm. Yeah, it does keep you honest.
Yeah. If I had, I wish that I had known of a program like that when I was flailing around. I mean, the fact that I'm a dropout shouldn't discourage people. I'm glad I dropped out of college. But
yeah. Well, Goddard is, as an undergraduate, similarly, I wouldn't have survived at any other college. I almost dropped out of Goddard even.
Wow.
Because I'd spent a summer in West Virginia chopping wood and cooking in wood stoves. And wanted more of that. And fortunately, an instructor said, just get your degree and then if you want to go back. But Goddard was the only place where I could do something like that because it was so loosely formed. You know, you were allowed to follow what you needed to do. And so then Vermont College was an outgrowth, I think, with certain instructors from Goddard.
Well, there was an MFA program at Goddard that then part of it ended up at Vermont College. Yeah.
So anyway, we are approaching the end of our time. You have given us on the radio. That's the only end of our time we're approaching at this moment. Any last words or words of advice? And you've been so generous with your experience and your words. But any just last words for the writers listening?
I guess I'll get a little political. I want to quote the son of Cesar Chavez, who described his father as the most impatient man. Impatient because he worked all the time. And patient because he never expected to see everything achieved during his lifetime. And I feel like that's the only thing we can do is to hold on to the urgency of our work, but also let go of the outcome. Mm-hmm. We have to just do it.
Yeah. If we had another hour, we could talk about that because the results often get in the way of the writing where you're just thinking too much about publishing and you're thinking too much about, you know, who's going to like this? Who am I going to offend? And it so gets in the way.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was so much fun.
Yeah, it's fun to
Let's
have
go to
you.
West Virginia and cut wood. That All sounds right, good.
Yeah. It was fun. I was at the Orange County Fair the other day, and I just stood by this cow. Because the Orange County Fair, there's lots of rural stuff going on. Just stood by this cow, and I remembered living in West Virginia and how we lived with a cow. And it was so cool to have a cow. And I'm just standing there going, you know, I think it's time for the farm again. Hung out with the llamas. That was very cool, too. I don't know. I don't know where I'm headed, but anyway. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
It was Diane Leffer here in the studio talking about California Transit. A collection of short stories by Sarabande Press. reviewed in the LA Times a couple of weeks ago. So you can go online and read that. You can also, I don't know that you have a, do you have a website? I found you by Googling your name.
Yeah, Googling me. I have a website, but it's embedded inside the Dramatists Guild, so it's a very long name, so it's easier to Google it.
Yeah, if you Google Diane Leffer, L-E-F is in Frank, E-R, you'll find lots of stuff on her, interesting stuff, interviews and various things, reviews of the book and wonderful stuff. So happy to come across a book of short stories that I wanted to read. So thanks again. All right. We are at the end of our time. If you want to know more about the show, you can go to my website, which is penonfire.com. You can email me from there if you like to be on the weekly email list that I shoot out so that you people know who's coming on. And I think that's it. I'm going to leave you with a quote by J.K. Rowling, who said, "It takes a great deal of courage to stand up to your enemies, but even more to stand up to your friends." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. See you next time.